Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
He's like, I will go when I feel like going.
Well, he's literally just
like, that's fine.
He's sitting there giving me a little side eye.
And now he's love that man.
Oh,
I love that man.
Hey, everybody. It's Kai. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us, as we like to say, is as smart as all of us on this podcast. It is Tuesday, our deep dive into one single solitary topic.
Exactly. This is the day when really none of us is as smart as all of us, because we pull in today not just one guest, not just one voice for you all to hear, but two, in fact.
Andy Euler is based out of Austin, Texas for us. He's at KUT there in normal times. I'm sure now he's probably in his basement or something. But more to the point, he was there during the blackouts and the big freeze last week. He sent us this about what was going on and what might be happening from here.
A week after the longest sustained freeze that I've ever experienced in my life as a Texan, it's sunny and 75 today in Austin. It almost feels like the climate is gaslighting us. That's not to say things are back to normal. Grocery stores are finally open normal hours, but the shelves are bare. And we just got word last night that we didn't have to boil our water anymore in Austin because the treatment plants were back online. But there are still so many Texans without any water at all. Some argued that this week's blackouts in Texas weren't due to a major design flaw, but simply extreme weather. So if weather is the excuse, and there's no real push to redesign the way that the market works, it seems that Texas, at the very least, needs to have a backup plan in place if and when things like consecutive days of freezing temperatures happen, because science tells us that it's going to happen again, which means these events are going to be more common, and it will, at some point, make economic sense to be ready when they do.
That is Andy Euler, of course, in Austin, Texas. And he's, you know, you can hear him being so professional there. When he says we, he really means we. Yeah. Like, he was boiling water. He was keeping his, you know, water dripping to make sure that the pipes wouldn't freeze, didn't have power. Like, he really has lived through this alongside everybody else. And so we appreciate him putting on his radio voice and still doing this good work for us. But as he pointed out, this disaster in Texas has people thinking about preparation, about who is going to help them be prepared. And it is an object lesson, right, in climate change adaptation happening right before our very eyes. Most investment, as we know, has gone toward mitigation, the idea of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, slowing global warming. Very little investment goes toward adaptation, also often referred to as resilience, the idea of a climate policy that focuses on protecting people, homes, communities, infrastructure from the effects of a warming planet.
And that's where our guest comes in. Jay Coe is the managing director of the Lightsmith Group. That's a private equity firm focused on climate adaptation technology. Jay, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So let me get straight at it. That last bit from Andy about the economic effects of this thing. Do you think it's going to take realizing the economic impact to make people really pay attention to climate change?
Well, I think people are realizing that it is climate change, and we still see the attribution studies on what happened in Texas. But this happened before, right? So the kind of time machine back to 2011, when they had the last cold snap in Texas, was when they came up with all the recommendations about weatherizing, which then they kind of ignored for the last 10 years. And so here we're right back at it. But I do think that the wake-up call in terms of the fires in the last several years in California and Australia, and now the kind of extreme weather events we're running out of names for hurricanes and seeing Texas freeze over are making people really start to think seriously about this problem.
I mean, is there a point at which it stops being this kind of like academic conversation about mitigation versus adaptation and resilience and just becomes necessity? Like, it seems clear that, you know, in Texas, 10 years ago, there were warnings about weatherizing. the infrastructure. And there was just a decision made, a financial decision made to not do that, to sort of like hope for the best. Are we getting to a point where we're just not going to be able to make those calls anymore?
I think absolutely. If you're living through the California wildfire season now, and your utility has either just gone bankrupt or told you that it's going to be fires like this and possible 10-day power interruption for the next indefinite number of years, then your world is really different than it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago, right? So if 10 years ago you were looking at this, the idea that there would be, you know, massive winter storms in Texas or giant wildfires across California wasn't the first thing that came to mind when you think about climate change. And we'll sort of see what happens over the next 10 years. But there's going to be lots of folks in the Midwest that are facing flooding, lots of impact on the coasts as well. And I think people have to take this seriously as an economic problem, not just one that's sort of either an academic consideration or some future risk that we're not going to see for some period of time.
Can we talk terms a little bit for a second? Adaptation versus mitigation, economic impacts and realities thereof, and what you're thinking about?
Yeah, so mitigation is this idea that we should reduce the trajectory that we're on global warming. So that's, let's reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's been the focus of most of the effort in the climate change and climate finance universe in the UN system or in the US and other places. And then adaptation is the idea that you need to prepare for the risk and impact that physically is going to manifest now as climate change starts to unfold. So even if we're very successful and are able to keep global warming at 1.5 degrees of warming, there's still dramatic impacts that happen. You lose the Marshall Islands, you lose lots of different communities. So it's not like 1.5 degrees is okay. It's just not sort of a Jerry Bruckheimer film. So working towards adaptation is really kind of a critical element. I think this idea that you can sort of segregate the two in your mind is no longer going to be an option. So, you know, I was talking to other folks about the net zero commitments that people are making to reduce emissions and making this transition to a low carbon economy. And they talk about green assets versus brown assets. And when you think about the physical effects of climate change, there's going to be resilient assets and destroyed assets. And so whether they're green or brown in terms of how carbon intensive they are, they all need to be adjusted for an environment in the future that's going to look quite different than it does right now.
Let's dig into some of the areas where we can make that investment. Obviously, right now, with, like you said, California wildfire season and PG&E, bless them, and then ERCOT in Texas, it's clear that the grid, in some ways, the power grid and the electricity, or the power grid, rather, is not necessarily prepared. Is that the place to start, or are there other adaptation strategies we should be investing in, like, frankly, decentralization?
Well, I think overall, it's the most immediate place where you're seeing the impact of this, but there's all kinds of knock-on and ripple effects. And it's not just that the grid is unprepared. Different parts of the grid are unprepared, right? Like, you know, I'm here in New York State. I sit on one of the state energy boards. And, you know, as soon as the Texas event happened, people were calling up and asking how our, you know, electricity system was going. And we have winter here and we're prepared for it. We actually weatherize wind turbines and we protected our energy grid here. And so that has a very different effect than it does in Texas if you're not prepared for the same set of conditions. Similarly, PG&E went bankrupt, SoCal Edison did not. And so they both continue to face wildfire risk, but the management, the choices that are made and so on are quite different. Where I think you can actually have dramatic improvement and a path forward really is investments initially in data and analytics to really understand what the path of this risk actually is going to look like and what decisions you can make around them. So that's better modeling of how these sets of events are going to occur, as well as products and services and solutions, many of which already exist that are just applied in advance of these events, and then also adjustments in the design of what you're going to do going forward. So, you know, what happened in Texas is sort of fascinating because not only did it shut down enormous amounts of the energy sector, which knocked out also a lot of the water supplies that you're talking about as well, but you're going to see ripple effects in people running out of the raw materials to make fertilizer. You're going to see impacts across the supply chain. You already saw this immediately in the reporting around COVID response where there was interruptions in the distribution of vaccines, operations in trying to vaccinate people. So you have this whole series of events that's going to start to become more clear as these events start to happen more frequently.
Does it make you crazy, though, Jay, that you are sitting here making what I'm going to assume are million and multi-million dollar decisions on a topic where, not to be too pejorative, But you get all kinds of banana pants people out there saying, no, come on, it was snowing. How can climate be warming? You know?
Well, I do think that there is still some analysis to be done in what attribution you have for these kinds of extreme events. But the general idea that things are changing, I think, has now kind of sunk in. So, you know, you can point to a range of different views as to what's been causing these events. But there has been, you know, another record year of $210 billion of losses in 2020, up from $166 billion the year before. Most of that's not insured. And these kinds of events are becoming more frequent and more severe. So I think the reality of climate change is upon us. And so you may have different views about how you experience that reality, but it's certainly going to affect your power, your water, your healthcare, your supply chain, your buildings, your infrastructure, and eventually your employment and your economy.
Yeah. Let's talk about that economy part, specifically the kind of finance aspect, your bread and butter, if we will, to all of this. We now are starting to have conversations about financial risk at the level of the Fed. You have Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen creating a new climate czar post to tackle potential risk to the financial system posed by climate change. How much do you think is all of that going to make a difference in terms of directing investment at a higher level?
I think that's a great question. I think the collision you're seeing right now is three different forces. One is there's a broad movement on disclosure that's really come initially from Europe through something called the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure. So it's now mandatory in the UK as it is in France and New Zealand, and I think it'll be broadly mandatory across the European Union, that companies and investors will have to assess and report both their transition risk, or what kind of risk they have from stranded assets that are too carbon intensive, as well as their physical risk. And I think some form of that will start to come to the United States. A number of investors are already signed up to have that disclosure, to ask for that disclosure from companies that they're investing in and from folks that they're working with on the investment landscape. The other side of it is exactly what you said, which is the regulatory side. So there's something called the Network for Greening the Financial System, which the Fed signed up to last year, which is central bankers and also regulators of insurance and pensions that are now starting to stress test banks for these kinds of risks and considering imposing new ways to calculate insurance reserve requirements and banking reserve requirements and impose costs or potential regulatory aspects on pensions and other investors. So when you have disclosure on the one hand, like you have to say what you're doing, and regulation on the other, which is we're going to tell you what's going to happen if you don't, that starts to drive people towards actually thinking about these risks in a more systematic way. The last piece is really affirmative investment. So there's a number of investor coalitions that have agreed to focus their capital on either net zero related investments or focusing on what's called the Race to Resilience, which has been released lately. And then others that are beginning to invest around this transition affirmatively. And I think that's where everyone's sort of waiting to see what the programmatic stimulus is going to look like in the United States, just as it has in Europe around affirmative investment against these kinds of transitions.
So what's the more persuasive case here, right? Regulation, as you just described, or affirmative investment, which is to say the opportunity to make some money?
I think it's a little bit of both. First, people are wondering, what do I have that's at risk? And the answer is kind of everything is sort of at risk. And sort of it makes you, you know, sit up and take notice when you thought you were investing against the idea that maybe California would continue to buy power for the next 5 to 10 years and you bought municipal bonds from PG&E. You weren't betting on whether or not there was going to be gigafires that were going to bankrupt that utility. So the first thing folks are doing is trying to figure out, you know, where there might be potential hotspots in their own investment and retirement portfolios, because that really kind of hits you where it counts. The other side of it is where the opportunities are. So the transition that you're seeing in terms of people thinking through where, you know, where do we go from here? Where does the economy start to grow jobs? Where do we actually think about the industries of tomorrow? I think is you know, probably being most prominently displayed in things like the run-up in Tesla's market cap, the enormous amount of SPAC activity that's going on in the electric vehicle transition, and also ESG-related investments that are going on out there as well.
So opportunity, ultimately, right, with a planet-size addressable market.
Yeah, I'd say without
plus existential risk, like it might be time to go. It's time
well,
to go now.
I think –
get in the game.
I think, you know, our strong view, strong form view of this is twofold. One is there is a great opportunity and a great necessity at the same time to invest initially in what we would describe as sort of tools. So where is this risk going to occur, and how do I practically get my arms around it so I can make decisions about it? The value of that information will get larger as that risk gets more complex and get larger. And then what solutions are there today to sort of managing that risk or reducing it, whether it's financial solutions or physical solutions that can solve that risk? And the need for those kinds of products and services will also get bigger as the problem gets bigger. That's the next couple of years. And then beyond that, there's, you know, much more interesting developments of technology and systems that could yield much different returns.
Real quick here, though, Jay, there's a time horizon on this, right? Because it's getting warmer faster.
That's true. Mm-hmm. You know, the difference between now and, let's say, 5 or 10 years from now, or 5 or 10 years ago, is that the idea that climate change is some kind of future 2100, you know, no more polar bears problem is no longer how people are thinking through this. They're thinking, my kids have a lot more childhood asthma now in Southern California because there's a lot of wildfires. And you put that on top of the COVID situation and you've got, you know, really kind of a collision of crises.
Jay Coe, he's at the Lightsmith Group. They do climate adaptation technology and investing. Jay, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jay.
Yeah, you know, it just... pay attention, people. Pay attention.
Pay attention. I mean, I was just actually texting with Kimberly Adams today about how no one wants to, you know, no one wanted to take the threat of the pandemic seriously. No one has wanted to take climate change seriously for, I should be clear, 100 years.
Yeah.
100 years ago is when a woman scientist first discovered, essentially, that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere could cause warming. That's how long we've been talking about this. And we are only now starting to convince some people. And Jay, of course, is optimistic, right? He's like, people are starting to figure it out that the climate's here. But that is, but a lot of people still blamed wind energy for what happened in Texas. So there's still a lot of money to be made in all the things that have damaged the climate so badly. So we're like still having the fight, even though the actual existential threat is already arriving. It is on our doorstep.
Well, yeah. And the fight, just to get back to that, you know, wind energy thing, the fight was political BS, right? That was absolutely the Republicans in Texas saying, ooh, we got to go after the Green New Deal and AOC. And it was wind energy. And sorry, Governor Abbott, no, it wasn't. And that was, yeah, that's a whole nother thing that we on purpose didn't get into with Jay because there was plenty to talk about. But as long as we're fighting that fight, then the whole mitigation adaptation strategy fight is just harder. It's just made harder.
It's just made harder. Yeah. Exactly. Like, it is time for serious people to come up with serious solutions. Like, enough. Enough.
Right.
Okay, we're headed to a break before we get all mad about stuff. Send us your comments on today's show. We are making progress. We are starting. It is good. You can do that by sending us an email or a voice memo to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Obviously, we prefer the voice memo. Thank you in advance. We will be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
All right, we're back. News is upon us. Molly Wood, go.
Mine actually is not so much a news story. It is a really thought-provoking Twitter thread, which is, I think, always, I don't know, that's like what our show is about. Anna Mardal writes and says, I really feel like we need to start talking about the pandemic tax we've been paying for the last 12 months. Because, you know, yesterday on the show, we talked about how plenty of people, like have money. They haven't spent it. They're sitting on this trillions of dollars of like pent up demand, and they're going to start buying stuff. Mm-hmm. And he writes, the masks, the hand sanitizer, the disposable gloves, the face shields, the extra cost of being home all the time, the heating and the cooling, the toilet paper you would otherwise use at work, the electricity, which I think we can all agree is a large bill. I mean, he writes about the tips that we keep paying, like for me at least, because I'm just apparently like a giant softie. I pay 20 or 25% in tips every time I order anything because I feel terrible that these people are bringing me food. And anyway, it's just really, it is a remarkable thread. And it says, and this is kind of heartbreaking because it should be enough that we have upended our society, traumatized our children, lost 500,000 people. But he writes, maybe if we drive home the fact that the pandemic costs us money, the talk of pandemic relief funds won't be restricted to people who have nothing, but who deserve, obviously, much more relief than just pandemic relief.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
All kinds
and,
of costs.
And I don't think it has sunk in yet. Maybe because we're all just trying to freaking get by and I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's a good one. That's a good thread. That's a good thread. Twitter's interesting.
It was just really good.
For sure.
I know.
For sure.
Yeah.
I've got two items, one a little gossipy and the other one much more substantive and kind of unbelievable. There's a piece in the Times today. Some research on women in the field of economics. And as listeners to Marketplace will know for the past couple of years, economics has been trying, without a whole lot of success, to deal with the gender and also racial issues that it has as a profession. Very few women, very few people of color. And it turns out in the Times today, those women are treated really badly by their professional colleagues. It's an article about a study that was done by Justin Wolfers and some other economists. Justin Wolfers, a friend of Marketplace, about the kinds of questions that women get at conferences during their presentations. And the reason it's a big deal is because when you're giving a presentation, you want to get into the flow, you want to do your presentation, you want to lay out your facts and your evidence. And what happens at these conferences, Justin Wolfers and his colleagues found out, is that female economists, when giving presentations, get 12% more questions than men do. And those questions, and this will come as no surprise to the women in the audience or the woman on the other end of this microphone, those questions are hostile and patronizing. And I just, I can't for the life of me, I can, but I can't understand how the HE double hockey sticks this keeps happening. You know, it's just, it's, people are just jerks. I'm sorry. I don't want to get us the E because I got yelled at last time I got us the E. So
yeah,
it's unbelievable. So there's that one. I recommend it to you. It's by Ben Castleman in the Times today. And the other one, a little gossipy thing from Political Playbook this morning. Political Playbook is the Washington Inside the Beltway gossip sheet, basically, of what's going on. And they reported this morning that Tim Wu, who has been a guest on this podcast from Columbia, antitrust, big breakup, big tech guy, is conceivably in the running to join the National Economic Council in the Biden White House and maybe conceivably even the Federal Trade Commission, which would, if he's allowed to do what he has advocated in his publications and work, would be interesting for big tech because Tim Wu thinks big tech is too big. And that's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That would be such a strong signal. Like you already have Amy Klobuchar, who we talked to on Marketplace Tech, plug. Week before last, introducing really pretty, because Tim Wu has been on our show and made this argument that essentially existing antitrust law is plenty. Right. It is all we need in some ways to take on big tech. And Amy Klobuchar is taking a really similar approach, which is just like, you're too big and you can't be. And that would be such a huge signal to all companies of a certain size.
Yep.
It would be really interesting. And I have all the thoughts on women in economics and also the world, but thanks. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Totally. That's it for the news fix. Let's hear from all of you.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
All right, let's see. What do we got? Leading us off, we have a voice memo from another listener living through the disaster in Texas who sent us a voice memo last week.
Hi, Kai and Molly. Thank you so much for keeping us smart and helping us through the pandemic. My name is Francisco Arriaga, and I am living in Houston, Texas, where we have had no power or water for 4 days. Our state and local governments have failed to help us. We have no assistance. I paid way too much for 18 bottles of water just so I could drink. If there's any way we can get word out and spread awareness that this is not right, please.
Words out. Words out.
Yeah.
Wow. Words out.
Yep.
So I'm going to make a very awkward turn here, but his point about paying way too much for 18 bottles of water reminds me of the outrageous power bills that a lot of people in Texas are getting because it's an unregulated market. All the people who were able to provide power could charge and did charge a huge premium. And so there are people getting like five-digit power bills. And it will be interesting to see what happens, whether there is relief for those consumers from the government of Texas or conceivably the federal government. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
I think that, I mean, listening to that despair and the feeling that people have, and I think that a lot of people in America feel this way right now, interestingly, despite the kind of the politics on either side, the feeling is that no help is coming. Mm-hmm. That's the feeling we've had for the last year in this pandemic, that no one cares, right? That other interests are being prioritized or that no one can get it together for various reasons, depending on where you live, whether they don't want to or they can't or they won't invest. And the idea of getting that $10,000 power bill on top of that for a problem that you did not cause in any way, and of sitting in your home thinking, I guess all I can do is spend $150 on water bottles. I mean, I don't know how much you spent, but like, and sending a message to a radio show being like, please help us.
Yeah, that's
is why people don't trust government right now. Like, that is the fundamental duty of government is to take care of citizens. That's why we pay them our taxes. Like, it's just, I don't know. I don't have anything more coherent than that.
Fair enough.
But that's...
Fair enough.
But it's heartbreaking. Yeah.
Weston.
Bleep, bloop, lurk, help.
Yes. Weston, sixth grade math teacher in the Bronx, New York. Here you go.
I go back to school on Thursday when New York City is opening up the middle schools. And I am super excited, as are many of my students. However, most of the students in my school will not be going back. These students come from the communities that have been most hard hit by the virus, and many of them have families that right now feel safer keeping their kids at home. These students also deserve the best education. They need more teachers. They need access to Wi-Fi, working devices, and tech support. Right now, as far as I know, this isn't happening. If our goal is just to score political points, then open the schools. However, if our goal is to do the best by all students, then we need not only to do everything we can to safely open the schools, but also do everything we can to provide the best possible education to the students that will continue to learn virtually.
That's a really, really good point. Is that, this is going to be a dumb question because, like, apparently here we're just really far away from even having this conversation. But is that the conversation that they're just going to open schools and then end? I mean, I guess teachers can't do both.
Well, so there.
But I'm sort of stunned by the enormity of that. Like, now school is open, so you either have to come.
Yeah, well, so
or
there's.
Not
there's
get school.
I don't know how many school districts there are, but there are as many variations on this theme as there are school districts in this country, right? Like, my school district is talking about doing this hybrid thing where kids will come to school, they'll stay in small pods, but they will learn via Zoom, sitting in the classroom with the teacher on the Zoom. It's just, it's really complicated. And there are lots of variations on this. Lots of variations on this.
It really is.
Yeah. Okay, we end, as we always do, with the answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew you later found out you were wrong about? Elizabeth has this week's answer.
Sorry. This week's answer comes from Elizabeth. I'm on it.
That's right. I did it last week.
I'm gonna fully pull back the curtain because this couldn't be more relevant
to
today's, you know, to the entire topic of today, which is that basically we're having some problems with our internet. And my child keeps texting me during the show, freaking out because he can't get into class. And he's really afraid that he's like not going to do well because he has all this anxiety, even though he pretends he doesn't care. And it's very distracting and upsetting because turns out nobody can do this very elegantly or well. Even me. And I'm awesome at this. This week's answer, and also you got to buck yourself up, people, yeah. because nobody else is going to. This week's answer comes from Elizabeth, the nurse who sent us a voice memo because a while back she was getting her first shot of the vaccine. Today, however, she is going to make us smart and maybe make us smile a little bit about something that happened in her hometown of San Antonio, Texas.
What is one thing I thought I knew but later found I was wrong about? Well, I thought I couldn't love my hometown grocery store any more than I did, but I was wrong. Seriously. H-E-B, in my book, wins the Prepper Strategy Award, the Good Citizen Award, the Best Commercials Featuring Local Sports Team Award, all the awards. In hurricanes and floods, they show up. Crazy pandemic, they were prepared. And while so very, very, very much was wrong with the power grid, leadership, etc., of Snowmageddon 2021 here in Texas, they showed up again. If power went out, those in the store were able to continue shopping for 10 more minutes or so, and then they left with their groceries free of charge. They're working hard to keep shelves stocked, providing food and other services in the community. I don't say this as a shameless commercial, though they are pretty wonderful, but rather when I think about how they have operated in their communities and the care and preparedness that they have shown, I wonder why our leaders in local, state, and national government can't even manage to tie their shoelaces without burning it all down. Maybe not what you're looking for, but that's one thing that I do know.
No, that was pretty good. The whole tie shoelaces thing. That was good.
I know. I was that created an actual mental picture of the shoelaces like throwing off sparks. I mean, yeah, it's a great metaphor you've invented. And also, yes, H-E-B apparently has been super popular all along. I actually had read in the New York Times this story that they wrote about how they let people leave with the groceries for free. And that it's just, and it caused the article was so interesting because it was like it caused then everybody in the parking lot to start helping each other because they were all in such a. They were all put into such a good place by this act of generosity and care that they all started caring for each other.
A little pay it forward. That's
beautiful.
Cool. That's very cool.
I know. We'll have a link to that in our show notes. And that is it for today's show. Thanks for all of your patience with me. I appreciate it. Don't forget to send your questions for tomorrow because it'll be What Do You Want to Know Wednesday to make me smart at marketplace.org. Subject line. Questions. See you then.
So you know what's interesting about you pulling back the curtain actually is that we never would have known had you not actually pulled back the curtain, and I think that's part of the I think that's part of the challenge. That's part of the challenge, right? That everybody feels this need to we got to keep it up. I got to keep doing it because that's what everybody expects. When in reality, things are exploding behind the scenes. Maybe even internet literally, right? So
The tweet that I saw today from Julian the Poet that blew my mind, made me feel targeted, and made me cry, said, friendly reminder that you can't out-achieve trauma.
Right.
And I was like, wow, America.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, the credits, Marissa Cabrera does everything. Tony Wagner does everything else. Erica Phillips writes almost everything.
Yeah. Marketplace tech producer Stephanie Hughes had the great idea to have Jay Coe on this podcast because we love him and we interview him all the time. Charlton Thorpe does everything. Emma Erdbrink mixes it. Ben Tolliday and Danny Ramirez write the thing. Donna Tam and Satar Nieves are just great.
There we go. Boom.
They're great.
We got to do the credits that way every time. All y'all know who does this. Boom, done.
It's just the way it's nice. It's nice. It's very efficient. It's very efficient.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.